You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Amtrak announced a new train route that will connect the Twin Cities with Chicago. We'll learn more about that coming up. But first, the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control have come under fire for categorizing Down syndrome as a birth defect. Disability rights advocates say that Down syndrome is not a birth defect, it's a genetic condition. They argue that calling it a birth defect reinforces existing stereotypes and misconceptions about Down syndrome. 3 decades after the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities still face discrimination in many ways, some of which are codified in law. Our next guest has spent years advocating for the rights of people with Down syndrome, like herself, and she's got a bill, the Charlotte Woodward Organ Transplant Discrimination Prevention Act. Joining us now is Charlotte Woodward, the Community Outreach Associate for the National Down Syndrome Society. She's also a senior at George Mason University. Charlotte, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
We're so glad to have you. I'd love to hear a little bit about your work and what made you want to become an advocate.
Well, I am a student at George Mason University, so I would probably say it was my education that snowballed me into becoming an advocate.
Yes, and I understand that you had a heart transplant when you were 22, and I understand that you were quite lucky that you had to wait only 11 days on the transplant list to get your surgery, which is quite rare. How did you realize that your experience wasn't common?
Well, that goes back to when I was diagnosed with a congenital heart condition. And as I grew, my heart couldn't keep up with the rest of my body. So I would have a fainting spell during which I would collapse. But thanks to my doctors, they advocated for me to get that life-saving transplant. And I want to point out that had I not received my heart transplant, I wouldn't be here today. And that transplant was the only thing that would save my life.
Wow. And I understand that there's a study from Stanford that says that intellectual and developmental disabilities are often used by doctors as a factor in determining whether someone can even get a transplant?
That is unfortunately true. But I would like to add that may, at some point, no longer be the case because of my bill, the Charlotte Woodward Organ Transplant Discrimination Prevention Act, which seeks to eliminate discrimination, and that discrimination can crop up in several places. For instance, doctors may decide not to refer a patient with a disability to a transplant program, or transplant teams could deny a transplant and not put the patient on a transplant list because of their disability. And another thing I want to point out is that why do we need such an important bill as the Organ Transplant Discrimination Prevention Act? Well, that's because people are traveling across state lines, as well as organs. And so there is a lot of ambiguity there on a local level, despite NDSS's push for local and state laws. And that's why we need a strong federal bill. And there are two organ transplant discrimination prevention act bills. One is called the non-discrimination in organ transplantation. That's the state bill, and that is through the House. Or I say
on the state level.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's on the state level. Mm-hmm. But the Charlotte Woodward Organ Transplantation Discrimination Prevention Act, that has a two bills in on a federal level, one introduced in the House and another introduced in the Senate. How did it become a Senate bill? Well, that's because a tragedy involving the case of a baby named Zion who was born with Down syndrome, but after 5 days of intensive surgeries, he ended up dying right after he was denied a transplant. And Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Hassan use that as momentum to get it introduced.
And this bill that you've worked on would require that doctors not solely consider a disability when they go to make recommendations for patients to get transplants. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. And of course, this bill I had just talked about would take an emphasis off of the disability, because for a long time, people with disabilities have been saying or have demanded that people like doctors and other people in society to see people with Down syndrome and those with other disabilities to see us as people, not our diagnosis.
Yes. How long have you been working on this bill?
Oh, I've been working on it since 2018. I'd like to add that I didn't really know all this stuff about organ transplant discrimination when I had my heart transplant, so it was kind of a shock when I learned about it. And I'd like to add that this discrimination is the majority of the time rooted in fear and ignorance and bias.
Concerns that there wouldn't be adequate care after surgery. Doctors say that as for why they would make those decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'd like to add that that's the case only if patients don't have an adequate a support network. But if they do have an adequate support network, they are able
yes.
to make those decisions.
And that's the work that you're doing. Where does the bill stand now?
Right now, the bill is still in the House and Senate, and we have had over the past several months efforts in talking with U.S. Representatives and senators to get co-sponsors, and we're still pushing hard. But I'd like to add on the organ transplant front that we are in the 21st century. You would think this issue would be a thing of the past. Yes. But as you can tell, that's not the case.
that's not the case. Well, we will keep watching the efforts in this bill, and we will watch your work. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
I appreciate you being here. Charlotte Woodward is the Community Outreach Associate for the National Down Syndrome Society. Last year, a bill to prevent organ transplant discrimination was named after Charlotte in honor of her work on the issue. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about someone whose life was saved by doing his job.
When we're at work, we all have a number of roles. We can take on other jobs, wear several hats. Albert Watson is a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center, where he also hosts a cooking club. Here, he tells the story of the day he saved a life by taking a bit of his own advice.
I had 10 minutes left of my shift before it was time to go home. I was headed to the control room to relinquish my equipment when the timer went off. I informed my coworker, Walter, that I'd head back to the pod to check on the male youth. See, every 25 minutes, our policy is to check on every kid that's in their room. This was the kid whose mood seemed to change as the day went on. It seemed like the more people he talked to, whether it be a social worker, public defender, the police, the more emotional he became. I've been a detention officer for almost 10 years at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center. I've been training for a lead worker position and recently became the president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. For the past 5 years, I've facilitated a cooking group at detention. No, I have not been to culinary school. My passion for cooking started with my dad. I'm the oldest of four boys, and my dad would get us up at 6:30 a.m. just so we could eat breakfast, consisting of sausage, salt pork, homemade biscuits, eggs, and tomato gravy. Yeah, I'm country than the sugar sandwich. My dad could take some neck bones and barbecue them in the oven and make us licking our fingers shortly after engaging that dish. So when I cook with these kids, it's from the heart and with love. We made many dishes over the last 5 years, from deep fried Twinkies and Oreos to fried chicken and waffles. We've done homemade meatloaf, five cheese macaroni, lasagna and homemade garlic bread, patty melts, paninis. We always like to celebrate other cultures. So during the month of March, giving respect to the Irish, we did corned beef and cabbage, shamrock shakes and bangers and mash, which isn't really an Irish dish, but was one of the recipes that popped up when I Googled Irish dishes. Well, I can't forget the Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid is special when you're locked up. I bet you're all wondering, what do the kids get when they don't earn the lunch? They get hot dogs. Hot dogs I boil for about 4 hours. All I do is keep adding water to them. These turkey franks go from looking light brown color to this pale off-white spongy Vienna sausage frank. I once added green food coloring on St. Patrick's Day. I'm a damn fool at work. Some people think it's mean or cruel. I call it get your together. I can't reward negative behavior. You can't disrespect staff or be verbally abusive and earn the lunch. You can't steal a car on Wednesday night, get locked up, and earn the special lunch on Thursday. We'll shoot for next Thursday. The point I'm trying to make is do your job. A kid that's incarcerated has only one job, and that's to follow the program so you can get the hell up out of detention. As I entered B-Pod, I walked to a room, B3. As I opened a small window of B3, I wasn't sure if what I was seeing was real, but it was. The male youth was hanging from the side of his toilet sink. I radioed for staff to call 911 and ask for assistance in B-Pod. I then opened the door of B3 and entered. Walter had just arrived. I instructed Walter to open the first aid drawer and grab the scissors from the first aid kit. And once I had the scissors in my hand, I began cutting the part of the sheet that was wrapped around this kid's neck. The kid let out this grunt of a sound, which let me know that he just might be okay. I gently placed this kid on the floor and wrapped several blankets on him to make him as comfortable as I could. Continue to talk to him and assure him that he was going to be okay. The point I'm trying to make is that I was doing my job that day. That timer went off after 25 minutes and that kid needed to be checked. A good thing happened from doing my job, and that's what I try to teach these kids during their short stay, the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center.
Albert Watson's story came to us from the podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. He's a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center and just finished his term as president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we'll learn about a new Amtrak train to connect Chicago and Milwaukee to the Twin Cities. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. A new Amtrak train will soon be running through Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. The route, called the Twin Cities Milwaukee-Chicago route, will travel between, you guessed it, Chicago to the Twin Cities, making 8 stops in Wisconsin. The route's an extension of the already established Hiawatha line connecting Milwaukee and Chicago, as well as the Empire Builder, which connects Chicago to the West Coast. And today, we have with us Terry Brown, the Vice President of Public Relations for the Wisconsin Association of Railroad Passengers. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Molly.
Good afternoon. I'm glad you could join us. Let's start with this route. So we've got the Hiawatha, we've got the Empire Builder. How will this route work?
Not much differently than it already is, quite honestly. There's a little bit of improvement needed on the Canadian Pacific main line, the freight line over by La Crosse and into Minnesota up to Winona. And the Hiawatha is in process of having some improvements on the line. So Canadian Pacific has said that when the Hiawatha improvements are finished, the TCMC can roll even before the TCMC construction even begins. So the three projects that have to happen for the Hiawatha improvement is the station at Milwaukee Airport. The second platform has to be constructed. I can't believe Canadian Pacific freight trains actually roll through the Milwaukee station right now. It's a crazy scene if you catch it sometime. The second project is a creation of a cutoff that goes through what's called Muskego Yard, just south of the Milwaukee Intermodal Station.
Yeah.
That will get all the freight trains out of the station. And then they have to improve some signaling for a couple miles west of the Milwaukee station downtown.
So is this why we won't actually see this new train until 2024? There's all these additional construction projects happening in order to make it work. When I first heard this announcement, I was like, hey, a new train. And then I saw, wait, 2024?
Yeah, you know, these things don't happen overnight. And then there's this thing called COVID that came along and some supply side shortages. When I hear the passenger rail and the freight rail managers talk about their own projects, the first thing that always comes up is the lack of steel to make steel for the rails. So boy, we're in a tough situation. That's just one of a couple things going, but quite honestly, the concession from Canadian Pacific allowing the TCMC to start before the improvements happen in La Crosse and Winona, Minnesota, is huge. That's unprecedented in the United States, quite honestly. You know, very, very pleased with Canadian Pacific over that. We're kind of hoping that, you know, we get a nice summer and maybe a light winter. Maybe we'll have a Christmas present for Christmas 2023, you know, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And so passengers will see the same stops at the same stations across Wisconsin?
Sort of. The Empire Builder does not stop at Milwaukee Airport, nor does it stop at Sturtevant. So the TCMC offers people in the Racine-Kenosha area and travelers that are going direct from the airport access to Columbus, Wisconsin Dells, La Crosse, Winona, Minnesota. That's a unique bonus for the people that live in the far southeast Wisconsin area.
Direct to the airport. Gotcha.
Right.
I've taken that Empire Builder, but the other direction, west.
Right. But think about it. If you live in La Crosse, and I understand catching a flight out of La Crosse is crazy expensive, even before COVID. And say you decide You find a cheap airplane ticket out of Milwaukee to your destination. How do you get to Milwaukee Airport from La Crosse? Well, the Empire Builder was an option, but it stops in downtown Milwaukee. How do I get from downtown Milwaukee to, well, hey, right. If when the TCMC comes, you can go right from the station in La Crosse to the airport station. One and done.
Nice. And I understand there's some shuttles also maybe to the Madison area?
Maybe. That's been talked about. It's on again, off again. Yes, I personally know some people in Madison that would utilize the shuttle to Columbus to ride the train. Van Galder has bus service. I'm aware of that. The timing is not ideal. I get it. But man, maybe in 18 months, something will come along. What Amtrak and the Wisconsin Department of Transportation has talked about in the name of a shuttle is a shuttle that meets up with the TCMC train in Toma and carries people to Eau Claire. There's a lot of people in Eau Claire that are happy about that. They'd rather have a train, you know, mind you. But the fact that there's a shuttle bus that'll take them from Eau Claire to Toma just to catch the TCMC train is good.
Gotcha. Well, we will keep an eye on this as it rolls along. Well, thank you, Terry, for joining us.
Certainly.
That was Terry Brown, Vice President of Public Relations for the Wisconsin Association of Railroad Passengers. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at kids and social media and what's being done to affect their mental and physical health as they increasingly use social media. It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the FDA has authorized a second COVID booster for people over 50. We'll talk about who needs it and get the latest science. But first, when American and other world governments began sanctioning, freezing, and seizing assets of Russian oligarchs in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it highlighted the size and scope of where this incredible wealth is laid around the globe. And this story may draw more attention, as our next guest will explain, to the hidden worldwide system of taking one country's dirty money and relocating it to clean and hide it. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about global money laundering? Who's doing it? How they're getting away with it? What's being done to stop it? What comes to mind when we say the word kleptocracy? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@wpr.org. We have with us Casey Michelle, a writer, analyst, and investigative journalist with a background in Russia, Eurasia, and Eastern Europe studies. He's also an adjunct fellow with the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. His latest book is called American Kleptocracy: How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. Casey, welcome to Central Time.
Molly, thanks so much for having me.
Well, can we just start with the word kleptocracy? What does it mean to you when you say that?
Yeah, sure, Molly. That's a great question. You know, if we think about the term kleptocracy, literally, it literally means rule of thieves. We think of kleptos, we think of ocracy. You see where the term actually comes from. And in many ways, you can still use that term to describe so many governments, so many regimes and dictatorships around the world that seem to be dedicated only to enriching themselves, their friends, their inner circles, their cronies, and not in things like democracy or development in and of itself. And we can certainly still use kleptocracy to mean some of these regimes, especially, I think, in places like Russia, as we've seen so clearly over the past few years and certainly the past month. When I'm writing about kleptocracies, though, and this is really what we've seen over the past maybe decade, maybe two decades at this point, as we have this kind of greater awareness of how the broader offshoring and financial secrecy economy works. You know, when I'm writing about kleptocracy, I'm not writing about one government or one regime elsewhere. I'm talking about an international, transnational phenomenon that sees these kleptocratic regimes, these oligarchs, these dictators, not keep their money in those original countries, but instead move that money elsewhere, move that money across borders, across countries, across entire hemispheres in some cases, and all too often bring it in to places like the United States of America. And this uses a bunch of different industries and loopholes and exemptions. But when I'm talking about kleptocracy, and when others are talking about this term these days, we're not talking about one country or one regime. We're talking about a multi-jurisdictional, transnational phenomenon that sees, in some estimates, trillions of dollars simply looted from some countries by some regimes and then moved elsewhere. It's no longer just one country or one dictator. This is now a global phenomenon.
And you're right that America is really the global magnet for this. How did that come to be?
Yeah, boy, Molly, that's a great question. That was kind of the reason that I wrote the book in and of itself, because I think when a lot of folks think of, you know, these offshoring economies, these offshoring jurisdictions or financial secrecy jurisdictions that are really the core countries, the core areas that are hiding and laundering so much of this money. You know, I think a lot of folks still think of these kind of traditional, literally offshore places, you know, these small islands in the Caribbean, these small places in the South Pacific or in the Mediterranean. Without realizing this transformation over the past decade, two decades, three decades, especially since the end of the Cold War, when it has been these Western countries and especially places like the United States of America that now provide so many of these traditionally offshore services in a very real way. Places like the U.S. have brought these traditionally offshoring services back onshore. We haven't really come up with a good term to really capture that. But when I'm talking about this American transformation, I'm talking about things like the American anonymous shell company industry. I'm talking about things like the American trust industry. I'm talking about things like the American real estate and luxury goods and private equity and hedge fund industries. All of these different industries, some of which are worth tens of trillions of dollars, that have no anti-money laundering checks, no reason for any of those that are receiving this ill-gotten or illicit wealth to actually ask where that money came from. And in so doing, strip that money of any identifying information, any ability to track it back to its original source, while nonetheless continuing to allow these oligarchs, these dictators, these kleptocratic regimes elsewhere to still control all of that money and do whatever they would like with it, all while plowing, again, trillions of dollars into things like the American economy. I mean, again, I'm talking about, certainly as an American, for largely American audiences, about this especially American transformation. I do think it's worth highlighting, though, this is a transformation we've seen take place elsewhere as
right.
well.
But Casey, why is it more lucrative, as you suggest, this kind of inshoring, this coming back to the U.S.? Why is it more lucrative to park your money in the U.S. in a shell company yeah. here in, you know, Nevada, say, as opposed to the Bahamas?
Yeah, no, Amal, that's also a great question in and of itself. You know, one of the reasons that so many of these oligarchs and these kleptocrats, these dictators come to the U.S. is because they have all these services freely available to them. Obviously, on the one hand, we have significant property rights and rule of law in the United States of America. But over the past two, three decades, we've also seen all of these services develop right here in the U.S. And again, across the country, not just in Washington, D.C., but around the country in state after state that are providing all of these ease of access, all of these abilities to set up these offshoring networks right here in the United States. You have states, entire states like Delaware, like Nevada, like Wyoming, like South Dakota, these smaller states that realize they have, on the one hand, the sovereign right to set up all these anonymous shell companies without any oversight from Washington, D.C. But on the other hand, they realize just how lucrative it actually is to provide all these offshoring networks to kleptocrats and oligarchs around the world. I mean, again, Molly, we're talking about trillions of dollars in illicit, ill-gotten, and suspect wealth that is always constantly looking for a home and what we have seen sprout up in the United States of America, not least because the U.S. is simply the biggest economy in the world. But we have seen time and again these states, these jurisdictions, these industries opening their doors to all of this dictatorial and kleptocratic wealth, welcoming it in, stripping it of any identifying information, and then beyond that, allowing those oligarchs to continue controlling it. And as we now see, opening up this whole can of worms about national security crises and far beyond that we're only just beginning to deal with.
Well, does this give the U.S. potentially some leverage, as we've seen with the Russian situation, if the assets are on American soil, so to speak?
Yeah, yeah. So there is an element of this that in some of these oligarchic cases, at least out of Russia, maybe these oligarchs got a little bit out over their skis. Maybe they thought a little bit too highly of just how wide open the United States of America would be. Now, again, we're talking about a decades-long process that has been allowed to develop that we're only just beginning to clean up, we're only just beginning to realize is a very real national security threat here in the U.S. And elsewhere. We've been able to target and identify some of these oligarchic assets. We've been able to identify some of their mansions, some of their yachts, some of their cars, and certainly these oligarchs don't like to see some of these assets actually taken from them. In a certain sense, there is some leverage that the U.S. has, but I think, Molly, the thing to remember is there are still so many industries in the United States of America, to say nothing of other countries elsewhere, that are still so drenched in anonymity, so wide open to these oligarchs, that we frankly have no idea where they've hidden the rest of their money. Because of the shell companies, because of things like anonymous real estate purchases, and again, not just luxury, condos and mansions, but also commercial real estate and apartment buildings around the country, to say nothing of private equity and hedge funds. We know the money is here, but we have such little insight into where it actually is that any leverage we might have is still just a fraction of what we should be able to actually have on our own end, let alone be able to identify.
Well, Casey, we've got a caller for you. We're going to go to the phones now. We've got Joe in Baraboo calling in with a question about the definition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So, you're causing some confusion here. Klepto in Latin, in all of my understanding, means to steal or to be a thief. And you keep calling them oligarchs, which are, to me, they're... they're probably the same thing, but by definition, not. Can you explain how your book is titled this way? And you haven't really talked about thievery yet.
Where the money's coming from? Yeah, thanks, Joe.
Yeah, Joe, that's actually a fantastic question on your end. You know, one of the things that I write about a lot in the book is this notion of dirty money or illicit wealth. You know, one of the problems that Western policymakers, including in the U.S., have faced for years is that so much of this money tied to so many of these figures, these oligarchs, these dictators elsewhere, so much of it was gained perfectly legally insofar as we're talking about any kind of laws that exist in places like Russia or in places like China or in other dictatorships around the world. Technically speaking, these figures didn't break any laws whatsoever. Now, we know looking at this that oligarchs in places like Russia or other post-Soviet dictatorships, they gained all of their money through links to organized crime, gained all of their money through links to rising dictatorships, including those like Vladimir Putin in Moscow. If you look at it on its face, it's so clearly ill-gotten. That is to say, there wasn't any kind of fairness. There wasn't any kind of entrepreneurship. These aren't figures that are interested in investment or jobs creation. They simply used access to, again, organized crime links, links to dictators to seize so much of their wealth and then use that, use these offshoring networks to move it into places like the United States. When we're talking about kleptocracy, we're talking about this level of gargantuan thievery that on the one hand, according to the laws of places like Russia, you know, they didn't do anything illegal. They're not going to jail for any of this seizure, for any of this asset accumulation, again, that they move and hide and launder in the West. What we're talking about is fair play at the end of the day. Did they gain fair access to these assets? It's very clear that they did not. It's very clear, again, their links to mafiosi, their links to dictatorships allow them to create these incredible war chests of assets that, again, they move into places like the U.S. or Canada or the U.K. So when we're talking about kleptocrats, we're talking about these figures that didn't build themselves up from nothing, but that seized what was out there or seized what was in national budgets or should have gone to roads or schools or hospitals. Well, these are the kind of typologies of dictators and oligarchs that we're talking about.
We'll talk more about this, Casey. Yes, yes. We're talking with investigative journalist Casey Michelle about his latest book, American Kleptocracy, How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. What about this story is standing out to you or resonating? What's missing from this story? Call 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenson for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Casey Michelle, investigative journalist, author of the new book, American Kleptocracy, How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. We'd love to hear what you think. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Well, Casey, one thing I want to ask you about vis-a-vis the Russian assets that we've been hearing so much about is what actually happens to these assets that are seized by the government. I hear there's some effort in Congress here in the United States to potentially redirect those assets to Ukrainian relief efforts. Yeah. What have you heard about this?
Yeah, Molly, again, a great question. And something, frankly, that American, you know, policymakers have been dealing with for years and years, you know, long before the recent war in Ukraine is, you know, if you are able to identify an asset, you know, a mansion, a boat, some high-end artwork, and seize that from an oligarch or seize that from a dictator and his family, you know, we know that money should have gone to the people of, in this case, you know, places like Russia. But how do you return that money to that country, knowing full well that that regime is still in place? How do you actually have any kind of oversight that that money won't just be stolen yet again? There is no easy answer to this. This is something that, again, policymakers have been dealing with for years and years. And I will say it's been, frankly, maybe a breath of fresh air that folks in Congress out in Washington right now are considering something that's actually new in this space. That is to say, using the proceeds of all these seized mansions, seized yachts, seized high-end automobiles and the like, to send not back necessarily to Russians themselves, even though those were that was the populace initially pilfered and pillaged, but to send it to the Ukrainians that are actually suffering on the ground from Russian aggression, send it to Ukrainian war efforts, Ukrainian relief efforts. Now, again, this is something that's only being discussed right now. We haven't seen any kind of details, let alone agreement on this, but this is something that's at least novel and new in this space. And certainly if it's returned to Ukraine or dedicated to Ukrainian efforts, it'd be a lot easier to get them the money than it would to be trying to set up some kind of new oversight committee in Russia and assume that that money won't just be stolen again by President Putin and his inner circle.
Right, right. Well, we've got another caller coming in for you. I want to go to Grant County where Jay is on the line. Good afternoon, Jay.
Good afternoon. This is a very prudent topic. I want to thank the journalist for his hard work on this subject. I currently am working in Grant and Crawford County with a group that's trying to raise assistance for Ukrainian and Russian refugees who hopefully will be coming to this country for sanctuary. But my question is, in this kleptocratic society, how does illegal labor fit into the ill-gotten gains of these kleptocrats, and what can be done to stop it?
Jay, that's a fantastic question. I mean, I'm not going to pretend to be any kind of expert as it pertains to the broader illegal labor sector, but what I can say, what I have worked on in the past, is that, you know, we're talking about these kleptocrats, we're talking about these oligarchs, we're talking about these dictators using these offshoring networks, and what we know is that so many companies, so many organized crime groups, so many other networks elsewhere that use and rely on things like illegal or undocumented labor also rely on these same exact offshoring networks. They rely on anonymous shell companies. They rely on anonymous investments to move and hide and launder their money and to throw investigators off the scent to make sure that any investigations into their networks are not actually followed through. So when I'm talking about these offshoring finance networks that, again, are provided in spades in the United States of America, as well as elsewhere, it's not just the oligarchs that are taking advantage. It's those that are engaged in any kind of illicit or underhanded means, any kind of illegal activity. Anyone who has a little bit of dirty money burning holes in their pockets are also turning to all these offshoring sectors that in so many cases are still perfectly legal right here in the United States of America.
So what efforts, Casey, have there been to try to rein this in? Is there any interest? Have there been any efforts?
I will say, Molly, one of the silver linings to all of the horrors we've seen out of Ukraine in the past 4 or 6 weeks is that it frankly does feel like something of an inflection point, at least here in the U.S. right now, when it comes to tackling so many of these issues. I mean, I think there's, you know, just the fact that we're talking today, this broadening awareness that the fact that Russian oligarchs, among so many others, are turning to places like the U.S. to hide and launder so much of their money. And we're still very unclear about what exactly they're doing with all that money right here in the U.S. You know, just last year, the Biden administration finally elevated corruption to a core national security threat. That is to say, placing it on par with things like nuclear war and terror. And actually, just late last year, a few months before the invasion, they released, the White House released the U.S.'s very first, first ever anti-corruption strategy document, which tackled so many of these issues we've been discussing today: anonymous shell company formation, anonymous real estate purchases, anonymous private equity and hedge fund investments, and on and on. Now, again, so much of this is rhetoric at this point. So much of this is simply saying the right things at the highest level of the American government. We still have to see how much of this actually translates into policy. But both out of the White House as well as Congress, just last year, Congress formed the Bipartisan Counter-Kleptocracy Caucus, which is kind of a mouthful.
That is
but
a mouthful.
At the end of the day, he has been launching bill after bill to address so many of these issues. And again, all of this now culminating in the horrors and the bloodshed we've seen out of Ukraine. So, Molly, it's technically too early to tell. We have to wait and see. We have to keep the pressure up. But there is a reason that I am cautiously optimistic about where things are going in the U.S. and elsewhere moving forward.
Well, what about this part of the National Defense Authorization Act that you mentioned? What does that stand to do?
Yeah, so this was a bill that was passed in early 2021, the very first day of last year. You know, this is a bill that's passed every year, the National Defense Authorization Act. It has all kinds of defense spending mechanisms in there. But last year was something a little bit different. Last year had a specific provision within it called the Corporate Transparency Act, which finally, for the very first time when it passed, made the formation of anonymous shell companies in the U.S. illegal. That is to say, it finally ended the practice of forming anonymous shell companies in the United States of America. And again, as we've been talking about, Molly, the U.S. has been the go-to destination for anonymous shell companies. This is the basic bedrock of all these kleptocratic networks.
So that's finally, it? They're now banned? They're done?
Well, not quite yet. We're waiting for the final language, the final regulations to come out. And certainly, as we've seen before, these things can have exemptions. They can have loopholes. So we've been keeping the pressure up in Washington, or I should say campaigners have been keeping the pressure up in Washington to make sure any loopholes or exemptions are tight. But you know, I don't want to undersell how important this bill actually was. Year after year after year, this bill had been proposed and it failed. And finally, last year, we saw it actually pass. We're waiting for the final details, the final language. But boy, it was an important moment in this broader fight against kleptocracy right here in the U.S.
What other reform movements are you watching right now?
Well, I will say, to go back to that mouthful of a caucus that I mentioned just a moment ago, the Counter-Kleptocracy Caucus, which has been launching bill after bill and is, again, composed of equal number of Republicans and Democrats in Washington. One of the really important bills that they introduced, and this was in October, it hasn't yet passed, but this was a bill that was called the Enablers Act. And this is one of these kind of congressional acronyms that has a very long name that I can never remember, but shrunken down, the acronym is Enablers. And, you know, listeners may have heard this term over the past few weeks. When we're talking about enablers, these are the Americans on the ground that are working on behalf of the kleptocrats, the oligarchs, to move and hide and launder their money. These are the shell company operators, the real estate agents, the private equity investors, as well as increasingly American lawyers and law firms that can freely work and freely set up any of these offshoring networks that they want. This is a whole range of American professionals that don't have any kind of anti-money laundering requirements whatsoever and can work with any oligarch that they want. And if and when this bill passes, all it's going to do is place basic anti-money laundering checks, basic due diligence checks, to make sure that these Americans are no longer working in the service of kleptocrats or Russian oligarchs, or even for that matter, Ukrainian oligarchs, anyone from around the world that has a little bit of dirty money. It's going to be a significant step forward in making sure these American enablers can no longer be setting up these offshore networks that dictators, that oligarchs and kleptocrats require to hide and launder all of their ill-gotten gains.
Well, Casey, Michelle, we'll keep an eye on you and your work. And thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Molly, thanks so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Casey Michelle, writer, analyst, and investigative journalist. He's an adjunct fellow with the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. His latest book is called American Kleptocracy: How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the future of COVID booster shots. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.